It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, we all eat dinner. Sometimes you don't have an hour or two. You need the food now. The creator of the cooking site Smitten Kitchen joins the show with some advice for getting dinner on the table quick, and you could join in with your favorite fast dinner dishes. First, professional basketball star Brittany Griner was arrested last month in Russia, accused of possessing vape cartridges that contained hashish oil. She's remained in Russian custody since then with limited contact with the Western world, which raised concerns about her well-being as U.S. tensions with Russia have risen. U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price confirmed that embassy officials were finally able to meet with her and that the federal government is monitoring the situation.
We continue to insist that Russian authorities allow consistent, timely consular access to all U.S. citizen detainees in Russia. The consular officer who visited with Brittany Griner was able to verify that she is doing as well as can be expected under these very difficult circumstances. We'll continue to work very closely with her legal team, with her broader network, to see to it that she is treated fairly and that her rights are respected.
Despite Griner's high profile in the sports world and the tensions between the U.S. and Russia, her arrest hasn't become a major international scandal that might be intentional. Our guest today will share the latest details in Griner's case and how the parties involved are handling it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the Brittany Griner story? Maybe wondering why it hasn't gotten more attention? What questions do you have about her arrest, her current situation? What do you think the U.S. government should be doing to help? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jonathan Abrams is a sports reporter for the New York Times. He's been following this story. Jonathan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, how you doing today?
Good. Well, before we get into Griner's detention here, can you, for people who don't follow the sport, can you remind us how big a star Brittany Griner is?
Yeah, of course. Brittany Griner is one of the most well-known basketball stars, not just in the United States, but in the world. She won a college championship when she was at Baylor in 2012. She led her team to a national, to an undefeated record that season at 40-0. She was one of the first women basketball players to ever dunk with regularity. And when she got into the WNBA, she immediately became a force. She's won two Olympic gold medals. When we're talking about women basketball players and the hierarchy of greatest of all time, she is right up there.
And like many in the WNBA and other women's sports, she goes and plays in other countries in the offseason, in this case, in Russia. Can you talk about why that's so common in women's basketball?
Yeah, so a lot of players, especially the top-tier women players, are able to supplement the salaries that they make in the WNBA by getting paid 3-4 times what they get paid throughout the WNBA season. And the team that Griner plays for in Russia, Ekaterinburg, is comparable to the Yankees of Major League Baseball, the Yankees of old days, where they will just simply outpay everybody else to get the best star. So Griner was making well above what she makes in her WNBA season by supplementing her season and going overseas to Russia.
Now, Griner was arrested in mid-February. It took a while for that information to become public, it seemed like. Can you talk about the timeline and why details were initially slow to come out?
Yeah, so her team and her legal representatives, her agents, the WNBA, they specifically kept it quiet. Their hopes were to have it resolved through back-channel diplomacy and have her released without it becoming a global ordeal. After about 3 weeks, the Russian news agency TASS reported that Griner had been arrested. They didn't immediately specify her name at the time, but they said that it was a two-time Olympian that released the footage that showed it was definitely Griner. Why they decided to release it after she had been already arrested for 3 weeks, we don't know. But that kind of let the cat out of the bag where some of the Western media outlets began making their inquiries.
How severe are the charges against her?
It's very, very severe. When we look at the drug laws in Russia compared with the United States, they would be considered draconian, where she is facing up to 10 years incarceration for having this hashish oil, allegedly.
And that's a key word there. the Russian legal system, I think people are right to be skeptical about it. How much sense is there that their information is reliable, that someone in Brittany Griner's position would get a fair shake in the Russian legal system?
Well, this is somebody who's been to Russia several years, and you would think that she would know the ramifications of carrying drugs into the country. So that's number one. Her high school coach is somebody who I talked with yesterday. She's still very, very skeptical over these charges. There's been other Americans who have been held on what American officials believe have been trumped up charges. So there really, really has to be a lens of skepticism when you look at these charges these allegations that are being made against Griner.
Talking to Jonathan Abrams, sports reporter at the New York Times, looking at the detention of Brittany Griner, WNBA star in Russia. You can join in with your questions if you've been following the story. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Jonathan, of course, Russia invaded Ukraine over this span of time. How much does that complicate the diplomacy as State Department officials are trying to deal with a country here with obviously a lot of serious tension going on?
I mean, you think about the timing of all this, and the timing, unfortunately, for Griner, it couldn't have been any worse. She was arrested right before the invasion happened, and at a time when the relationship between the United States and Russia is non-existent. I don't think it's a stretch to say that at all. So her representatives, they want to have it be something that's separate from the global crisis that is going on with the invasion of the Ukraine right now. But I don't think that there's any doubt that Russia sees this high-profile American as a bargaining chip. And it's unfortunate for her because this timing couldn't have been worse.
As you mentioned, the WNBA and Griner's family and friends initially had hoped to keep this quiet, not make a big international deal of it. Now the information is out that she's there, and it still seems like they're not pushing for sort of an international public pressure campaign. What have you heard from Griner's family in particular?
Nothing other than Instagram posts. Mm. They've been very, very quiet. At the very beginning, her agent made a statement, but it was very telling that her agent didn't even use the word detain. I think the phrase was just that they're aware of the situation in Russia. So they've been very, very specific about not saying anything at all. And even the United States State Department, for a while, they wouldn't even say Griner's name because they've just been very, very leery about trying not to make this an international issue or give Russia leverage to think that they have a bargaining chip that they can use down the road.
Now, I mentioned at the outset one small piece of good news here. A member of the U.S. consulate finally able to visit her, and it took a while to make that happen. Can you talk about what we know about the circumstances of that visit and what we learned from it?
Yeah, so it was a request that was immediately made, and it took a few weeks, and it seems to be a common happenstance when Americans get detained in Russia that whether it's Griner or whether it's somebody else, that they have trouble gaining American consular access. So she was able to finally meet with the American consulate this week, and they reported that she was doing okay, that she is reading books and shares a cell with two other detainees arrested on the suspicion of drug charges. So it sounds like she's doing as well as can be possibly asked for, but it's just tough seeing the end point in all this, especially with the global crisis that it's now wrapped into.
We're talking about the arrest of Brittany Griner in Russia. New York Times sports reporter Jonathan Abrams is with us. He's been following that story, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Brittany Griner's case is getting enough attention? Do you think it should be a bigger story? Some sports columnists have made the case that if this was a famous male athlete, maybe somebody with a higher profile, it might get more attention, including in the media. Or do you think the lack of attention could help her cause? Call 800-642-1234 with your comments, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Jonathan Abrams, sports reporter at the New York Times, with us today to talk about WNBA star Brittney Griner in custody now in Russia. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Brittney Griner's case is being treated differently in the media? Maybe because she's an LGBT woman of color in sports. Would the coverage and response be different if she were a man in sports? Call it at 800-642-1234 with your reactions, your thoughts, your questions on this story. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to a caller now. Gianni is with us in Montello. Gianni, hello.
Yes, hello. Hey, listen, I spent a couple of years in Leningrad in the early 90s after the breakup of the Soviet Union. And I can tell you, I really feel for this woman because she's in a very serious situation, particularly in Russia, not a place you want to be. But my question is she charged with actual possession of hashish, or is it considered a narcotic or a hallucinogen, or are we talking about the CBD oil, which is, I guess, you know, there's no THC in it, so perhaps she was taking that for pain or something. The media hasn't really made that clear, so I'm a little bit confused. Could someone explain exactly what the charges are?
Gianni, thanks for that. And I'm a little confused too, Jonathan, because I think I've seen in your reporting that the Russian authorities say hashish oil. I swear I saw somewhere somebody had reported it as CBD oil. Here in Wisconsin, that would be a very big legal distinction. What do we know about that?
That's a great question. And back to the beginning of our conversation, I'd said that the drug laws were draconian. And I said that for a reason, because she is being charged with transporting large-scale drugs. So that's what she's officially being charged as. And I had to actually look up what hashish oil was. And as far as I can see, it's something that can be used in here. It doesn't seem like it's this great big drug that can be used all across, and is something that can be viewed as something that is that bad. So, yeah, it's very draconian.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Now, Brittney Griner, an LGBT woman of color in Russia, not a very gay-friendly country. I think that's a massive understatement. Is that raising the concern for Brittney Griner?
I think the totality of the situation raises the concern at every level. She's African-American. She's gay, she's prominent. I think you take all those combinations together, mix it with what's going on in Russia right now, and you have a very volatile situation.
Thanks again, Gianni, for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Jonathan Abrams, sports reporter for the New York Times, looking at Brittney Griner currently being detained in Russia. Jonathan, you and your colleagues talked to other people who had, at some point in their lives, been detained in authoritarian regimes around the world, and got their thoughts on how, you know, Brittney Griner's family and others are handling this. What kind of things did you learn from them?
That it's really a mixed bag of whether you should make an outcry and make public demands about what the government is doing to try to get your loved one out of an authoritarian country, or whether to stay silent and hope that back channel resolutions and diplomacy will be able to help their cause. I do not think that there's a right recipe to extract somebody out of a country like this, especially with what's going on globally right now. So I think it's, you know, we know which direction her friends and family are trying to take. It hasn't been fruitful right now. But then you look back to a few years ago, when UCLA basketball players got detained for stealing in China, they could have been under a really bad situation as well, but that was able to be resolved within a week. And I think actually President Trump was about to visit China at about the same time. So that got managed through back channel resolutions. And I'm sure that Griner's family and representatives were hoping for the same outcome on this situation.
Griner's colleagues in the WNBA, have they spoken out much on this, or are they kind of observing that let's not make a big scene of this in hopes that that smooths the resolution?
For the most part, they've been observing it and staying silent. There's been a couple people, Jewel Lloyd and Lisa Leslie, have been a couple people who have spoken out. The WNBA season starts in May, and that's about the next time when Griner's next hearing is going to be in Russia. So you would imagine that as the season starts rubbing up, people are going to be talking about it and discussing it more.
What kind of things are you watching for next when it comes to, you mentioned that hearing coming up in May, when it comes to whether, you know, the U.S. consulate is going to keep having access to check in on Brittany Griner's well-being?
Yeah, so what we're going to be following is the access, any news that comes out of Russia on how she's doing, how she's faring, what she's facing. One of the things that was crucial with the case of the UCLA players who I just mentioned was that the owners of the teams and the sponsors who they were playing in China were very, very integral in helping them get them out of the situation that they were in. So we're trying to find out about these Russian oligarch owners and whether they're going to be able to play a role in helping Brittany Griner get out, because you have to imagine no players are ever going to want to play in Russia again based on the combination of what's going on with Griner and what's going on globally with the invasion in Ukraine.
In just our last few moments, Jonathan, what to you is the biggest unanswered question that you are trying to find answers to right now?
What's the end game? We're at a time when diplomatic negotiations are at an impasse between the United States and Russia, and we have one of the world's most prominent athletes in a jail right now. On even if she did do this crime, which is an allegation made by Russian authorities right now, you can't imagine that any American citizen would expect to transport this oil and face a 10-year charge. So what can be the end game? How can Griner get out of this situation and get back on American soil?
Jonathan, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate it.
Jonathan Abrams is a sports reporter for the New York Times. He was with us today talking about WNBA star Brittany Griner's arrest in Russia and how her case is being handled. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about reimagining archaeological digs on tribal lands.
Frog Bay Tribal National Park sits on the shores of Lake Superior. It's on the land of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, also known as the Anishinaabe. Frog Bay is the first tribal national park in the country, and for the last several summers, it's been home to a collaborative archaeological project between tribal leaders and university archaeologists. The goal is not just to find new artifacts, but imagine a new way for everyone to work together. A new podcast from our partners at Wisconsin Humanities called Human Powered has the story. Here's host Jimmy Gutierrez.
For the last 3 years, the Red Cliff Tribal Historic Preservation Office has been collaborating with two archaeologists helping excavate sites on tribal lands. During these digs, students, researchers, and tribal community members work together to learn about the people who have lived on this land for millennia and to connect that knowledge with the people who still live here today, which for so long hasn't been the case of archaeological work.
Indian people has been studied to death. You know, study after study after study after study.
Marvin Defoe is the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for Red Cliff, otherwise known as the TIPO.
They say, well, this is how they used to be. That's what they used to do. So that word they disconnects everybody in our whole community. We're here today, we're alive today, we ain't going nowhere, we're alive today, but there's a story on how we came to be.
The TIPO office is in charge of a lot of things. Things like the annual powwow, the language school, and making sure that none of the sacred sites get disturbed. So sometimes Marvin gets calls from archaeologists. Archaeologists like Heather Walder. Heather works at UW La Crosse and the Chicago Field Museum.
I remember calling Marvin just cold to speak with the TIPO to talk about this project.
You know, when Heather gave me a call in Red Cliff, do you know of any place in Red Cliff that maybe we could kind of take a look at, whatever, and I started thinking. I said, yeah, we go out Frog Bay.
The dig started at Frog Bay Tribal National Park in the summer of 2018. Asking tribal members for input is crucial as the group makes sense of what they find in the ground. For example, take the bunches and bunches of cracked rocks that were being found all over the site. Marvin had an idea.
Heat them up, put them in a container. I call that a Anishinaabe microwave oven, you know.
Marvin's Anishinaabe microwave came from a story he heard from an indigenous elder in Canada. That elder took his grandkids out for the weekend to share traditions. And one morning, they caught a fish and started a fire.
You know, so he took the fish, heated up them rocks, and had the trough, and he put that fish in there, and he put a little wild rice in there, and put them rocks in there, put the top on, wrapped it all up, and propped it in the bow of his canoe.
A few hours later, they had a delicious lunch cooked with hot rocks inside of a cedar log. Top Chef has nothing on this. Today, Marvin shared that meal with us. The same meal an elder shared with his grandkids just a few years ago. A meal that was shared with the people at Frog Bay who lived here 5,000 years ago.
We all have a job to do today. We all have a job to undo what happened to us as indigenous people. If you teach a child to love the land, that child will protect it. And part of how you love the land is you got to understand yourself and love yourself as a native person. And it ain't just doing the archaeological thing. It's you live it. Zitsigewin, you live it.
That story came to us from Human Powered, a new podcast from Love Wisconsin and Wisconsin Humanities. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Sometimes you've got hours to spend on making a meal. Maybe you track down special ingredients, get really gourmet with it. Other times, it's 6 o'clock, you need dinner, now-ish. That's when having a couple quick and simple recipes on standby can come in really handy. It's Food Friday. Our guest is here to share some of those quick dinner recipes with us, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are the recipes you go to when you need dinner on the table fast? Is it a quick pasta dish, an easy salad? Have you found ways to save time cooking dinner? Do you do a lot of planning ahead? Maybe weekend time to get something ready for the weekdays? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Deb Perlman is the creator of the cooking site Smitten Kitchen. She's the author of multiple cookbooks, including Smitten Kitchen Every Day, Triumphant, and Unfussy New Favorites. Deb, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me back on.
Well, you've got a family, a job that keeps you hopping, Deb. I think we've all been in that position. When do you find yourself needing that quick dinner?
Almost every day when I forget that despite having children for 12 years now, that they actually need to be fed, yeah. Even if you already fed them that day or the night before.
Yeah, I
know. It surprises me every day.
Yeah. And, you know, in my head, I'm like, no problem. I will always plan ahead and have something ready to rock or crock pot in the morning. But when it comes down to it, I'm just not that smart. So how do you overcome that situation? What are some of your first ideas that you go to when you're in that need it soon situation?
You know, I try to use it as like a last chance thing because I try not to call it in more than once a week, but pasta is definitely something that I find very helpful. You know, it's always nice to have a couple shapes and sizes on hand and a couple things that you can make with it. I love doing this dish, this quick pasta and chickpeas. The recipe is on my site, but it is so easy to make, and I love it because you also throw in a can of chickpeas, so you feel like you're getting something a little more nuanced than just like boiled pasta with tomato, and it has a really quick sauce, and it's kind of brothy, almost like a soup, and my kids actually eat it, which is always a small miracle, and I like the fact that I'm not just eating like a straight bowl of pasta every time I run out of ideas.
We've got that. That's one of the recipes Deb shared with us at WPR.org/Food Friday. You can check it out. Yeah, tell us a little more about what goes into this pasta with chickpeas. You got to boil the pasta. That's pretty quick. We're using canned chickpeas here, I imagine, because otherwise it takes a much longer time.
So you actually do not need to boil the pasta, and that is one of my
favorite
parts.
I read this one.
It's so cool. I love this. And I just wish more recipes would build this in. I mean, I don't think that all like cooking pasta in the sauce gets a great texture, but since we're going for something kind of brothy here, it works great. So what you do is you start, and it's such a short ingredient list too. I hope you can see, but you start with some olive oil, and then you're going to cook 2 cloves of garlic, and you're going to get some nice color on them because we want some real deep flavor. Then we're going to add tomato paste. We're going to have 3 tablespoons. And what you do is you're going to really cook this a little bit, so it's like a good shade or two darker. From there, you're going to add water. And this water is where you're going to cook your pasta. So you already have this garlicky tomato broth. You can put in red pepper flakes to taste. I like it kind of spicy, but I'm not feeding. Not everyone I feed agrees. So from here, you add 1 can of drained chickpeas, and then you just add half a cup of a small dried pasta, and you cook them together. And in this time that the pasta cooks, the chickpeas soften and it all comes together. So it really is just such a quick meal because you get to cook the pasta right in it. And I have this sort of finishing oil you can make with herbs and garlic if you want to make it taste like a little fancier. That also keeps it vegan, but Parmesan on top works as well, too. Yeah,
that's right. I remember when I read this recipe, it struck me. I can't think of other recipes where I cooked pasta in the sauce. You know, I usually cook it separately and then add everything together.
And I like to, just because it's sort of fun. I was never allowed to have SpaghettiOs growing up. I'm not sure why. When I get off the phone, I'm going to call my parents and ask them. But I never had SpaghettiOs growing up. So I was always like a little jealous of friends who did. So I love keeping that little ring shape around of dried pasta. Plus, this only uses half a cup at a time, so you'll have more left if you buy a bag. And I love the way it makes this dish look like SpaghettiOs, but like for grownups.
We're talking to Deb Perlman, creator of Smitten Kitchen, the cooking site, and author of cookbooks under the Smitten Kitchen label. She is helping us cook dinner on the clock. When you got to have something on the table soon for yourself, for family, for friends, join in if you have a question or a favorite go-to in that scenario. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Deb, you mentioned you like keeping the ring-shaped pasta around. What are some other key ingredients that you just always like to have around for that need-it-now kind of situation?
I feel like tomato paste is a really useful thing to have. I'm going to assume that we all have like an onion and some garlic around, but if you don't, just go buy an extra one every time you're at a store, and then you just obviously use the oldest one first. I think a good block of Parmesan or Pecorino is really useful to have. I feel like it sharpens up dishes really quickly. I always like to have a lemon or three. And I'm going to assume you have oil and vinegar and stuff like that, but I feel like those things. And also, I love to have either both frozen, just a box of it, and also just a bag of fresh spinach. I feel like these are really helpful ways to turn a kind of basic pantry scrunched together meal into something that feels a little more nutritious.
Now, not all of your recipes are quick. That's not the only kind of thing you cook. What does it take, though, when you're developing a recipe for it to get the quick label? What's the timeline? What's the cutoff date for you?
I'm looking at, for me to call something quick, I'm looking at usually around 30 minutes, but like I'm thinking 45 minute steps. And I mean 45 minutes with pulling the stuff out of the fridge, like with the chopping, with everything. I need to know that I could have like kind of forgotten that I needed to make dinner again and we want to eat at 6. And I started it at like 5:20 and I was not sweating at 6 and we were eating it. So I'm looking for it to be without an insane amount of rushing, for it to be really, truly done and for it to taste good and not like a giant compromise.
That is exactly the timeline I used to cook on when my kids needed to eat, you know, earlier because they went to bed earlier. And I got home from this show, like literally the 5:20 to 6 was. And so I would be picturing on the bus ride home, like every step, what like go in, turn on oven, get this out of the fridge. Then I can put the backpack down. Don't even, yeah. Do you
just
have
get
that
the water
like sort
boiling
of like,
before you've done anything?
Exactly.
But I'm not going to lie to myself either. Like if it did not get done in 30 to 45 minutes tops, I'm not going to call it quick because then I'm just lying to myself. Because when I'm going to my site to look for a quick recipe, I don't want to be misled either. So these were things that I've made and they really, truly get done quickly.
Now here's another quick one. This is another pasta one. It's a mac and cheese. And I love this because, you know, you can find lots of fancy mac and cheeses and you do some, but this is more in the boxed mac and cheese experience, which you're a fan of.
I am a great fan of it. I think powdered cheese is a beautiful invention. That said, I find this to be as quick to make as boxed mac and cheese. Like the only thing that takes like 1 minute longer, and we're talking one, and that's if you don't buy it pre-grated, is grating some Parmesan. But I think anybody who's a parent or anybody who craves macaroni and cheese at some point has wished that they had a go-to easy stovetop recipe that didn't require you to have three different types of cheese in the fridge, because I don't. And you could just make use of what you had. And so I started making it with Parmesan cheese, just Parmesan. Or if I have a sharp white cheddar, which is usually like a second cheese I would keep around if I'm looking for a second one, I'll use half and half. But I find that these two white sharp cheeses add a lot of impact and like that kind of boom of flavor you're looking for and that salty impact without needing a lot of cheese. And so I started making my sort of quick, that's sort of my actually quick stovetop mac and cheese with it. And it's just been, it's become an immediate staple. It is absolutely the thing I make if I am either just cooking for the kids, craving it myself, or maybe we're going out and babysitter's coming and I don't want to order food. So it's just, it gets made probably twice a month in my household.
Now, suppose you're a stereotypical Wisconsinite and three kinds of cheese is kind of the minimum you might have in the fridge.
Oh, my God.
What would be your favorite? What would be your favorite combo of cheeses to put on this quick mac and cheese?
My favorite combo, I would probably do Parmesan. I would either do Parmesan or Pecorino, and I would do some sharp white cheddar. I feel like 50-50 with a sharp white cheddar and Pecorino and Parmesan because a really nice impact. If you're looking for more of like a nutty, full-bodied, I don't know, fancy taste, I would add a little Gruyere, Comté, or Baby Swiss, like whatever you can get more easily with for a slight nuttiness. But I think that you can get a shockingly pleasant amount of flavor from the Parmesan and the white cheddar.
It is Food Friday. We're talking to Deb Perlman, creator of the cooking site Smitten Kitchen. She's with us today to talk about dinner recipes for when you're crunched for time but still want something yummy that the other people eating will also find yummy. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you now, or you in the past? Well, you're not cooking dinner yet, or maybe you are. I don't know. What is your favorite go-to when you need something on the table fast? Do you have a secret ingredient that you have to make that quick-made thing a little bit better? Are you too busy to share with us right now? Take just a minute. It won't take too long. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And don't forget, pick up a few recipes from Deb over at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation about fast and easy dinners for those times you don't have the time or energy for much else. Deb Perlman with Smitten Kitchen is with us, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have those moments where you got to get something turned around fast? What do you turn to get dinner on the table quickly? Do you need some advice from Deb? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Colleen joins us now in Viroqua. Colleen, hi.
Hi there. I'm excited to be on the show. My daughters found the Smitten Kitchen website years ago, and we use several of her recipes regularly, so thank you, Deb. Chewy oatmeal cookies. I think it's one that comes to mind that we make. But if there's a recipe we're searching for and we see that you have a version of it, we go there. But my kids are grown and gone now, and I just cook for my husband and I. And I've had a problem with Parmesan if I'm making a cheese sauce for pasta, like maybe an Alfredo, and I'm making it from scratch. The Parmesan clumps up in the pan, so I'm wondering if you have any tips for that.
Colleen, before I let you go, can I ask, are you using pre-shredded or pre-grated Parmesan, or are you grating it yourself?
I'm grating it myself.
Oh, okay. Well, that kills my answer, Colleen. Thanks. Deb, do you have any advice for Colleen?
I think there's two pieces. So first of all, I mean, I think that I always add cheese to a sauce at the very last. Like when I make my stovetop macaroni and cheese, I make this quick bechamel. I turn the heat off and remove it. And then I add the cheese because there's enough warmth in there to melt the cheese without it kind of melting too much and then splitting. And then you've got like that wicking out of the oil and probably more of a clumpy texture from the curd that's left behind. So that's the first thing, is I always add the cheese at the very last of the sauce. I think it's okay to do it on the heat, but I would do it last. The second part is, I find it can be helpful if the sauce wants you to cook it for a while, and this may not, you know, I don't know which Alfredo recipe you're using, but for the cacio e pepe on my site, a trick I learned from this wonderful Roman cooking teacher named Elizabeth Mancilli, and she learned it from a restaurant in Rome. But the restaurateur, he starts with, instead of using hot pasta water for his cacio e pepe, he starts with cold water. And it sounds crazy, but he blends the cheese into that and then he heats that. Huh. And it keeps the cheese from kind of melting and clumping, because you're not going to melt it and then warm it again, if that makes sense. So if you just think of it, cheese as having kind of one chance to melt well before it gets clumpy and separated, you know, just think of maybe adding the cheese a little bit later or adding it to a cooler point in the sauce.
All right, Colleen, couple things you could try there. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. All right, Deb, we got a third recipe you shared with us. It's up at wpr.org/foodfriday, another Smitten Kitchen favorite. Now, this one, I'm really interested in this. It's a simple chicken tortilla soup. Now, I got a sister-in-law from Mexico who makes an all-day cooking kind of a tortilla
soup.
Don't
show her this.
Yeah. I do one that's, you know, takes a while, but this one comes together really fast. I love tortilla soup. Could you tell us how this one comes together so quickly?
I definitely want to tell you about this one because it's a new recipe this week, except for the fact that I have been making it this way at home for years. I have made, I thought, what was like every chicken tortilla soup out there. And a lot of them just kind of tasted, they were good to me, but they took a while. I didn't really like starting with canned whole tomatoes. I didn't love the texture. When I've had it in Mexico, I remember there being more of a smooth, spicy tomato broth. And I wanted to make it that way. And when I did, I sort of accidentally realized that it was very quick to make soup this way. So what I do is I start with some chopped onion, jalapeno, and garlic. And we cook it together, you know, as you would when you start almost anything, until it's a little bit brown. Then we add some cumin and chili powder. I use the mild one because I'm cooking for kids. Cook that in for a minute. Then we add tomato paste. This shows up again like it did in the pasta and chickpeas. And we add a quarter cup of it. And this really makes the entire soup a tomato soup. We cook that for a minute. And from here, we add the chicken broth and the chicken. And we cook the chicken thighs right in this broth. It takes, I'm using boneless, skinless. So it takes just like really just about 15 minutes, not 1 minute more for the cutlets. Pull them out, shred them. And while you shred them, you heat up some beans. And if you want, you can add some corn to it too. Add the chicken back. And I'm telling you, that I told you about the 5:20 thing, like I could probably start this at 5:35 and we could eat it at 6 o'clock. Wow. It's incredible. It's so great. And it's full of flavor. At the end, you absolutely, like, it is not negotiable. You have to finish it with lime juice. I feel like it lifts the whole thing. And then if I have time, we either do crumbled tortilla chips, or I explained to you how to quickly make some fried tortilla strips. We'll finish it with avocado if we had it, some cilantro. And then if you have, I love putting some cotija cheese on it, on that crumbled, sharp, kind of funky Mexican cheese. And I'm telling you, it is the easiest recipe. Everyone eats it. You know, the younger ones act like it's sort of like a taco soup, which it kind of is, you know, dipping chips in. And I don't know, I feel like it's going over really well. And I feel like I should have shared it a long time ago, because it's become a really important part of our tired of cooking but want to eat something good arsenal.
That sounds fantastic. Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jen is with us in Manitowoc. Jen, hi.
Hi, and hi, Deb. I love your Instagram, and I've been following you forever. What? You're welcome. What I love, which we ate like multiple times a week this summer, was the zucchini, which barely hits olive oil, and then it has almonds and parm. That's your recipe. I know you said it was from a restaurant.
I love that dish. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And you're welcome. And I also make your slice and bake cookies all the time.
Cool. And Jen, are you looking forward to zucchini season this year?
Absolutely. Bring them on.
Thanks.
That recipe is from the old, I mean, it's not the way they make it because they make it more complicated, but it's from this recipe. There's a restaurant that was in Chelsea for many, many years called the Red Cat, and it's a quick zucchini saute. And you literally cook the zucchini in 2 minutes. You don't want to cook it longer. And it's just Parmesan and salt and pepper and some toasted almonds that you fried in olive oil. And it is like, I could eat a mile of it. It's so good in zucchini season.
Fantastic. Jen, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. We've had a couple of people mention your cookies. Now, obviously, you know, we're not necessarily hurrying to make those for dinner, except sometimes.
No, of course
but,
not.
Do you have favorite quick cookies or other desserts where you're like, I need something for company or whatever?
For that, and since I'm usually making it at home and it's often a weeknight and we just need a little something, there is a whole wheat chocolate oat cookie on the site that is really quick to make. It is whole wheat. I swear it is. The whole wheat is not there for nutritional aspirations. It was like over the pandemic, I realized that I liked my oatmeal cookies better with whole wheat. They're a little airier. They've got a little more texture to them and they have this they just taste nuttier and more wonderful. So I started making these cookies over the pandemic as one does with the ingredients I had around chocolate, oats, and a whole wheat flour only. And I love them. I mean, I have cookie recipes where you have to make the dough and cook it the next day, but I do not believe that is in the nature of cookies.
Yeah.
And the nature of cookies is I want a cookie and I want to put it in the oven right away. And it's one of those. It makes 12 3-inch cookies, which are a nice size. They can try asking for seconds, but I think after a 3-inch cookie, we're all happy. And it makes a dozen and it's really done in 20 minutes, including the baking time. So I love it.
Our caller mentioned your Instagram, and our producer pointed out something you have called real life menus on your Instagram, as opposed to what people might see on your site. I assume there's some overlap. What do you think about with a real life menu?
Yeah, I'm not trying to mislead people with the site. The site is still my cooking. But if we were talking about, am I going to cook something aspirational from the site 7 days a week? Oh, my goodness, no. And I have never tried to pretend otherwise. But I have this menu board I keep on the fridge, and it is less planning because I'm not a very good planner and a little more of just a rundown of what we ate on Monday and Tuesday. And I started sharing them, and I guess people like to see what you really eat. and sometimes it's a recipe from the site. Sometimes it's something new I'm working on. And sometimes it's one of these things I've mentioned where I am just tired and I'm not feeling it. And we threw something together. And people, I mean, I think we need to hear about this too. There's also like takeout and like there's been at least one night in the last month where there was peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for dinner because nobody was feeling it. But for the most part, I think it's what's real about it is that it's a mix of real cooking and just the cooking that you do because you ran out of time and this is what you had.
Well, you know, what I love about this is, you know, sometimes when my kids were, you know, around and I was cooking for them, I would definitely have those moments of guilt on those quick, you know, throw something together meals. Sounds like you're helping us take the guilt out of this a little bit, Deb.
I think you should take all of the guilt out of it. In fact, I think you should lean right into it. I think you should embrace it. And then once you've given yourself a break from the guilt and the cooking, you know, the heavy cooking, maybe you'll get your urge to cook back. Maybe you'll feel more inspired because you weren't giving yourself a hard time. So I more encourage people to be gentle with themselves. Sometimes it's been a long day. I don't think our kids are suffering if they eat once every 3 months a peanut butter and jelly sandwich or even more. This is not the great crime of their generation. So I just think that lean into it. And then once you've given yourself a break on that night, you might have time and energy the next time to start making something you care about more.
Deb, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Deb Perlman, creator of the cooking site Smitten Kitchen, author of a bunch of cookbooks, including Smitten Kitchen Every Day. She was with us today to share some quick dinner recipes and advice. Find some advice. Find some of her recipes at WPR.org/FoodFriday.